What's good, everybody? Welcome back to the Abstract Dynasty Fantasy Podcast. I'm AJ, episode 4, rolling right along here in the preseason, trying to crank these episodes out faster than a veteran running back can destroy someone's dynasty outlook. Looking at you, Zeke and Dalvin, potentially Leonard Fournette on the way. Quick update on that front, I did say in the previous episode when we were talking about Breece Hall that if a veteran running back signed, and even if it had been Dalvin Cook, that it wouldn't change my ranking of Breece in the tier that I have him in. I still agree with that. Signing Dalvin Cook is not the best case, but a one-year, $8 million contract on a running back that's going to get you competent play is very different from a different running back that we'll be talking about later in this episode. There's no draft capital involved in there. So might suck a little bit to project anyway once Breece is fully healthy and you have Dalvin and Breece at the same time, although Dalvin's not the healthiest guy out there. But yeah, I'm still comfortable where I have him. And Zeke Elliott will touch more on because his new backfield mate is in this particular tier for this episode. But we're going to be rolling on with tiers 5 and 6. If you're not familiar with how I do tiers, go back and listen to the previous episodes. But these two tiers right here, this is where things get a little bit squirrely. People start to get their feelings hurt. But this is one of the most important areas for you to nail in startup drafts and through trades, because a lot of your league-winning decisions can be made down here, because it's really not that hard to sort through the first, three rounds of players. Everybody likes the guys to a reasonable degree, and this is where you can make or break a lot of rosters down in this tier with some ambiguous projections or maybe some determining if something is over or undervalued. But again, we're going to start with tier 5, ascending, holding, or descending assets. Start off with the quarterback, and there's only one name here, and it is Kirk Cousins. Ascending asset. I consume a lot of different podcasts, one of them being the PFF NFL podcast. One of the running jokes on their show is the something called the Matt Ryan inflection point, and it was basically the watermark that you would measure all quarterbacks from rookie to veteran status to if you could be as good as Matt Ryan in a positive situation. You could be deemed keeping around worthy of that second deal. And if you're below that inflection point, it may be time to re-roll. Maybe there's some things going on there. And I a little bit feel that way about fantasy because I very much feel like Kirk Cousins is the perfect inflection point of what you should be looking for a fantasy quarterback. Don't really see anybody out there saying that Kirk Cousins is a stud, but he's about as good can get you without being great. The thing that's important to remember with Kirk Cousins and quarterbacks in general is that sometimes a good quarterback can flirt with greatness based on his situation. And throughout Kirk's career, he has been the beneficiary of some great receiving cores. Even all the way back to his days in Washington, he's worked with Pierre Garçon, DeSean Jackson, Jordan Reed, Jamison Crowder, and then moving over to Minnesota, he had Adam Thielen, Stephon Diggs, Kyle Rudolph. All of these guys have been fantasy relevant. And Kirk Cousins himself has been a back-end quarterback 1-4 out of the last 5 years. You know exactly what you're getting. And you know what? In the current iteration, it's never going to hurt when you have Justin Jefferson on the perimeter. He's one of the best receivers in the game. Minnesota also traded for TJ Hockenson. That was a success. He brought a nice element over the field for the Vikings. And Vikings took it a step further and drafted Jordan Addison in the first round this year. This is yet another great trio for Kirk Cousins to start with. Again, he's a little capped just because of his conservative play style. He doesn't really have much to speak of in the way of rushing. He may get into the end zone a time or two in a season. Also took a butt ton of sacks, especially this year. The Minnesota offensive line was a work in progress. He took the 6th most sacks at 49. That's a lot of hits. And because it's Kirk Cousins, the memes about primetime games do sometimes hold true. Occasionally, you do have those games, even outside of the bright lights, where the floor just drops out from under him and he has like a single-digit game. But all in all, a dutiful back-end QB1, high quarterback 2 that can flirt with some occasional 30 and 40-point games for you. And of course, he's 35. This particular contract structure year-to-year that he's had with the Vikings is just not sustainable. The Vikings are going to end up moving on. Even if that happens, assuming Kirk Cousins doesn't retire, I think he's going to be a shoe-in for another starting gig after Minnesota, if not multiple. Really, the bigger threat is just, Kirk Cousins has made a lot of money in his NFL career. I wouldn't say that 35 is too young to retire. We are a little spoiled with the Tom Brady, Aaron Rodgers length of careers that we've been seeing, but still a reasonable age to retire. That would be my only concern, but when I call him an ascending asset, it's not that I think he's going to improve at age 35. I'm just saying this is as good as it gets without being great. And that's what his value is on your roster. Now we'll move into the running backs. A lot of home run hitters here. We'll start with Tony Pollard, ascending asset. The longtime sleeper and hype bunny. Tony Pollard has been languishing behind Ezekiel Elliott in the Dallas backfield for years, despite excelling in advanced rushing and receiving metrics. Now it's wheels up. Cowboys finally parted with Ezekiel Elliott and his albatross contract. We finally got to see a lot of run for Tony Pollard this year. He was top five in just about every advanced rushing metric there was this year and had the eighth most yards after contact while splitting time with Ezekiel Elliott. And I'd say they're particularly relevant for him because Tony Pollard doesn't exactly profile as your prototypical size back. He's 6'2", 209, not undersized by any means, but he's not your workhorse build. He is a cut, athletic, gashing running back behind a great offensive line. I think the most pointless thing you can do is look at the two games that Tony Pollard put up without Zeke. Tony Pollard averaged 18 attempts and 3.5 targets a game and had 4 touchdowns. So I wouldn't be expecting those 4 touchdowns to definitely inflate his fantasy points over that span. But I think it's relevant to say that, you know, while I don't think Tony Pollard's going to get the 20 to 25 tote per game treatment, I mean, I'll take 18, I'll take 17, and I will take incrementally fewer rushing attempts on the ground if you're going to give me more targets through the air. I think they're going to try to lean on their defense a little bit more this year, and that bodes well for Pollard. Of course, though, there's mild questions about who Pollard's running mate is going to be. I highly doubt that it's going to be the current depth chart, which is at time of recording still Malik Davis and Deuce Vaughn. There are still some veterans floating out there. I mean, it's possible that they don't sign anybody at the end of the day. Tony Pollard signed this franchise tag. He will be featured, and I'll say featured in quotation marks just because they're going to get their money's worth out of him. Featured means a lot of different things. I think he'll be used more in the passing game. He's done very well with that. And anything else that they bring in is going to be a complimentary piece. That's the main thing here. So I'm fully ready for Tony Pollard this year. Now we got Kenneth Walker, another ascending asset here. Kenneth Walker was a borderline elite rusher. I loved his game coming out. He glides and moves a little bit different than some of the other backs up in this area here. And he was awesome once he got up to speed last year. From weeks 5 to 17, his 17 game pace would have been 1,400 yards and 13 touchdowns. He was awesome. He, just like Pollard and a couple other guys in here, is a home run hitter. He was tied for the third most runs of 15 or more yards and had the second most breakaway yards among running backs. He would be way higher in my list if not for the Seahawks drafting Zach Charbonnet. So this is what I was speaking about with Breece Hall. At the very least, Breece Hall's competition can be gone effectively this year if it needed to happen. Seattle went out and drafted Zach Charbonnet in the second round. Back-to-back years drafting second-round picks at running back is just a puzzling decision. I know they like to run the ball, but it's definitely going to be a thorn in the side for Kenneth Walker owners because of the type of player Zach Charbonnet is. He's a big bruising back at 6'1", 220, but he's also got some good receiving chops. So it's not like we haven't seen Seattle use two backs effectively, just something to consider for Kenneth Walker owners. I still think he's going to be the lead back, but it is going to be up to him to hold down the red zone work. He did have the second most red zone carries among running backs, so he clearly showed he can convert. That's not going to be an issue, but just depends on how long it takes Zach Charbonnet to get integrated and what that official split's going to be. And yet another home run hitter we got, Travis Etienne. I'm going to call Travis Etienne a holding asset, and that might be unpopular with some people. Like I said, he's a home run hitter just because he suffered the Liz Frank injury as a rookie. This was his first real rookie year. And how did it go? He was pretty poor on third down. Not going to sugarcoat it. He had a PFF grade of below 50 as a receiver and pass blocker, and he was used sparingly in the slot and out wide. One of the reasons we liked Travis Etienne coming out of college was because he stayed that extra year at Clemson to prove that he could do more receiving work as a running back. We've seen him catch the football, and we've seen him do that to great success. So I want to believe that this is just growing pains, you know, getting that first year pass protection. A lot of times first year running backs can struggle in. And once you add receiving responsibilities onto that, not everybody's going to hit the ground running. But when he was in space, when he did get those receptions, a whopping 10.2 yards after the catch per reception. was the second highest among running backs. He is a bursty threat. He left a little bit to be desired between the tackles, but he was okay after contact. The other thing that's kind of sucks about ETN is that they recently drafted Tank Bigsby, and the Tank Bigsby hype has been glowing. Doug Peterson, the head coach, has definitely been a running back by committee truther. Even going back to his time both in Kansas City as the OC and in Philadelphia. So I don't think it's realistic when he made that statement about hoping Travis Etienne reaches the 16 to 1700 yard rushing floor. Yeah, I'm sure everybody wishes their running back can do that, but it ain't going to happen for Travis Etienne. Not that he's not talented, but I don't think he's going to have this backfield all to himself. And but I still really like Travis Etienne. This whole offense is on the rise with Trevor Lawrence showing what he could do and where that team's going to be going forward. I do think they get that third down receiving role worked out a little bit. I think he improves in year two and one of the more exciting and explosive running backs out there. And now we're here, much to the chagrin of anybody who's been listening through four running back tiers and failed to mention Jahmyr Gibbs. Here he is, ascending asset. I'm going to put it to you bluntly, Jahmyr Gibbs is overvalued. I think he's an awesome player. He has the draft capital. He's a first-round pick. He went to a system that is probably going to facilitate some checkdowns because Jared Goff has shown a propensity to do that. So I see the dots connecting. I understand the hype for Jahmyr Gibbs, but this type of running back is very difficult to project success at the next level. So for every Christian McCaffrey, Alvin Kamara, and Austin Eckler that we get in fantasy, there's still going to be Clyde Edwards-Helaire, Antonio Gibson, and even on the Lions themselves, DeAndre Swift. There's such a wide range of outcomes for this type of running back. It's also a bit of a weird stylistic fit as well, because this is the same Lions team that just gave Jamal Williams 57 attempts inside the red zone and just sent DeAndre Swift packing. Then they turn right around and invest a first-round pick in a very similar caliber player. Like, I don't actually get it, honestly, but doesn't mean I don't like Jahmyr Gibbs. I really like the player. And the reason he's still in tier five for me is honestly largely because of the draft capital. But I do believe in OC Ben Johnson. I can almost guarantee he will be one of the top coaching candidates coming into the 2023 offseason. And I do want to see what his plan for Jahmyr Gibbs is, because I see the path to success. It's just this, again, this is just going to be a difficult pill to swallow with this type of running back. I'm not going to have them too high anymore. Skip right along to everybody's favorite steady Eddie, Nick Chubb. Nick Chubb is perennially underrated and explosive entering his age 27 season. This is actually his first full season that he's played since 2019, which I think was his sophomore year. Set career highs across the board, didn't need the extra games, but it did still happen. Rushed for over 1,500 yards, 1,000 of those yards came after contact to boot. He was incredible, as he is every year. The knock on Nick Chubb, obviously, is that he's a little bit older and still lacking in the passing game. I know there's hype about him potentially taking more of that role on with Kareem Hunt out the door. I'll see it when I believe it. It's not that he can't do it. It's just, we'll see. That's just not how that offense has functioned. I'm not just going to predict it out of thin air. As far as his production last year, he was mostly great. He did falter a little bit towards the end of the season. Coincidentally, when they made the switch from Jacoby Brissett to Deshaun Watson. Clearly that offense was out of sorts. Watson was out of sorts. But really the only complaint about him is that if he's not scoring touchdowns, you just don't always feel that big bump from a 100-yard game from Nick Chubb. But Watson should be a positive force going forward, and Nick Chubb has shown no sign of decline. He's one of the best backs in the league, and I'm all over Nick Chubb at a value pretty much any place that I can get him, because the dude just chews up yardage and scores touchdowns and never gets his due. He's a holding asset, by the way. I forgot to mention that. I got another declining asset here at the running back position, though, and it is King Henry. Derrick Henry is not a human. And he proved that after coming off for an injured season. Answered back with 1,500 yards and 10 touchdowns on the ground. As if he wasn't good enough, he was hilariously efficient as a receiver this year. Yeah, as a receiver. He, in his fifth year of mighty lordship, he who never cleared 20 receptions in a season, did in fact run 191 routes this year, ended up getting 33 receptions on 41 targets for almost 400 yards, yards per route run figure of 2.08, which is a stat that everyone everywhere should be laughing about until the end of time, because nothing about this man makes any logical sense. So if you're waiting for Derrick Henry's wheels to fall off, that's like the third year in a row now. I really don't like the directions that the Titans are taking right now. They are crumbling from the inside out. They may have lost Treylon Burks for quite a few weeks, meaning their passing game is anchored by 31-year-old DeAndre Hopkins, Chigakonkwo, and Nick Westbrook-Ikhina. This team might just suck. It just might. And he's 29 years old. But he is still playing in the AFC South. That's at least six soft defensive matchups a year. He is the most affordable running back in my experience. Especially in this market, absolutely no one wants anything to do with running backs, so I wouldn't be shocked if you could get two twos for him. But we're going to ride him to the wheels fall off. Even if he takes a step back, I'm still all about him in places that I'm competing. That's it for the running backs. Big tier, huh? Wide receiver tier is a little bit smaller here. DK Metcalf, ascending asset. DK Metcalf is legit at what he does. He is a true X receiver. He's big, he's physical, he's imposing, and when Seattle wears those all lime green uniforms, he literally looks like the Hulk running a slant out there. But I got him down here. We're a little bit removed from the heights of DK Metcalf. It's been a little bit of a roller coaster, I'm not gonna lie. I'll expound more upon this when we talk about our next wide receiver, but there are some holes in his game. He's got limited yards after catch. There's little to no involvement with him in the slot. Just, you know, scheming up that free shit like is really useful, and sadly he just doesn't get a lot of that. Would be nice if he did, but I don't foresee that with Seattle drafting JSN in the first round. I think he's gonna be the shoe-in favorite for all the slot work, so DK is gonna be left on the outside to do DK things. I do think he still has elite production somewhere in there. Everybody remembers the 1300 yard season he put up. But his elite production is probably going to lie in the deep ball and the touchdowns, which is just going to be a volatile aspect of fantasy. It's just going to be hard to string that together year over year and even week to week. So this type of wide receiver is still a great boom option, but needs to be properly supported with the rest of your roster. Stabilizing forces at your other wide receiver positions is definitely going to help you reap the benefit of when DK goes off. But there are going to be some more creator weeks, and that's just the nature of the beast with this type of player. I'm holding my breath for saying this one because people are going to freak the fuck out. And it's T. Higgins, also an ascending asset. And everything I just said about DK Metcalf, you could pretty much just erase DK and put T-E-E. He is a similar, less specialized DK Metcalf. Listen, it's not a knock on, he benefits from Jamar Chase drawing coverage and DK has a harder job. Dude, the difference in their production is almost negligible. So we're going to look at quite a few different stats here. Just box score stats. Regular season, 1040 and 7 for T, 1040 and 6 for DK. You with me so far? Good. Slot percentage, 19% T, 16% DK. For the most part, used exclusively outside. A little bit mixed in here and there. Yards after catch, 280 for T, 230 for DK. Little edge to T there. Yards per route run, 1.92 for T, 1.81 for DK. Contested catches, a stat that points out a very specific type of wide receiver. 16 for T, 20 for DK. Both of those marks were top six in the NFL. Broad strokes, they had very similar production in 2021. I know he was injured on and off. That's been the story of his whole career. You think it's just a one-off season? Go back and look at every single season that they've played in the league together. For their careers, you ready? T. Higgins averages 4.7 receptions a game. DK, 4.6. T. Higgins, 65 yards per game, 63 for DK. T. Higgins averages 0.4 touchdowns a game. DK's 0.5. And again, this is career average, so you're not really getting dinged for missing a whole bunch of time. And that's one of the main feathers in the cap of T. Higgins truthers, is what if he stays healthy? I'll tell you what if he stays healthy. He's going to be DK friggin' Metcalf. That's not a bad thing. I want that on my team. I will invest in that on my team. But this type of wide receiver is volatile, yet there's this profound belief in the fantasy community that T. Higgins will one day Hulk smash his way into wide receiver one territory and demolish the field and prove all the haters wrong. And I do think they're a little bit right. I don't think we've seen the best of T. Higgins. Shoot, maybe that ceiling is a little more attainable when you have Joe Burrow as a quarterback compared to Russell Wilson / Geno Smith. Maybe. I'll give it to you. But Think about what you're investing in. It's just still this type of wide receiver. This is not the direction the NFL is going anymore. 5, 6, 7 years ago, these guys might be taken in the first round because they're going to gobble up 190 targets apiece. That's just not where the NFL's going anymore. These guys have roles. These guys have upside, but don't freak out. What I will say about T. Higgins, though, is I brought it up when I was talking about Joe Burrow. It's looking more and more like if the Bengals can't figure out the cap situation, T. Higgins is going to be the odd man out. And maybe he does get that number one shot elsewhere, which obviously, not to shit on him any longer, he is a fantastic wide receiver, and he can be a number one. Not only does he have the skill set, but we got an extended look at T. Higgins, not only before Ja'Marr Chase came into the league, but while Ja'Marr Chase was hurt this season, and he did well. Like, he draws number one coverage. He will be an alpha wherever he goes. And I still see T. Higgins ranked as high as like wide receiver 12, 10 in Dynasty. I'm just not paying that premium for a guy that misses this much time, that has this nature of peaks and valleys in his weekly production, and that needs unprojectable outcomes of perfect health and one day being traded to capitalize on this great upside. But he's a great cornerstone piece to a roster. He's only 24. He's in a great situation, and I want him on my team. Just, I'm going to pay what he's worth. All right, let's move on to someone that's not so fiery. Drake London. You might have forgotten London even existed. Went almost unnoticed with how good the early returns are of this class, but that's no shine off London. 800 yards and 4 touchdowns is a solid rookie season. I know we're very spoiled. But this is great. This would have been considered exceptional a couple years ago. All his underlying metrics look promising as well. We're looking to see if he can develop with Ridder at the helm. I spoke a little bit about it with Kyle Pitts. That's just an unknown. But I think London can do a little bit of everything. I think he can play X. I think he can go in the slot a little bit. He's going to be a good movable piece in this offense that likes to put its playmakers in interesting positions. And I know I'm talking about London after I just talked about DK and T. Higgins, but he's actually not a lot like them. He is big. Like, he's big like them, but I think he's going to be a better separator than both of them once he's fully developed. Really, only reason he's not higher is that just we're in projection mode right now. This offense was crazy run heavy last year, and they just invested a top 10 pick in Bijan Robinson. But I really like London. Definitely going to be more of a dynasty piece as opposed to a contending piece. I could see myself trying to count on him for like some wide receiver 3 production, but that's a leap of faith I don't really want to take if I don't have to. Just wanted to point out that he was drafted first in this 22 receiver class for a reason. All these guys develop and grow at different rates, so don't forget about Drake London, because I think he'll answer back by this year or next year, showing that he belongs with the Garrett Wilsons and the Chris Olaves. And the last wide receiver I got here is Jaxon Smith-Njigba, ascending asset. First wide receiver taken in this past rookie draft, lands with the Seahawks. Seems a little crowded on paper, but I do really like the fit, especially long term. He's the latest Ohio State wide receiver to get rave reviews in the draft process. He tested very well. He will be an impact player, just we're not sure what degree of that is going to become in fantasy. There's a wide range of outcomes for him because, of course, they've still got DK Metcalf and Tyler Lockett ahead of him, though I think that'll shake itself out. Just look at their contracts and ages. But I do think there's a legit path to him being fantasy relevant this year because Seattle has desperately needed a difference maker in the slot. They really have not had anyone since Doug Baldwin to really fill that role. Getting JSN in the slot isn't just going to be good for him, but it's also going to be good for Geno Smith because he excels in the short passing game. Slot is a lot about quick hitters and timing and burst and acceleration, all things that JSN excels at. The scrutiny about JSN being a slot only, I don't think I give too much attention to right now, but it's fair noting that there's a kind of a wide range of outcomes for this type of prospect as well. On the higher end, you're going to have your CeeDee Lambs and your Keenan Allens. And on the lower end, you're going to have more of a Jerry Jeudy, Christian Kirk. I'd like to believe that JN's going to land more on the higher side of that, but you never know for sure. In a little bit, I'll talk about said Seattle Seahawks quarterback. I actually noticed a lot of people seemed really bummed about the landing with the Seahawks, and I loved it immediately. So if anybody's a little lukewarm on JSN, I was maybe hoping for him to be a sneaky top 20, 25 wide receiver out the gate with reasonable confidence, and that's in doubt now. Swoop in and grab JSN because I think he's going to be a great player going forward. But that's it for tier 5 because there's no tight ends here. Final thoughts on this tier? Maybe I'm being a little pedantic about having Kirk Cousins in a tier of his own, but it is really how I feel. If you want to move him up or down, that's fine. I wouldn't move him up. Don't move him up. That's kind of weird. I wouldn't put him up with Dak, Tua, and Fields. Kyler and the rookies. I think that's a bit of a stretch. But anyway, I do think he belongs here. I think the strength of this tier is obviously the running back. It's got the most players in it. But again, when you compare them to the last tier of Saquon, Austin Ekeler, and Josh Jacobs, you just don't have the same level of scary upside here. Same thing with the wide receivers. The last tier was a little bit capped with Amonra, Devontae, and Jalen Waddle. Now you're getting a little more capped with, you know, stylistically with DK and T. And you got your young upside wide receivers like London and JSN, but are mostly projections at this point. The running backs can kind of float in and around the third or fourth round of a startup. Really just depends. In a down market, nobody's really shoving these guys up the board except for maybe Jahmyr Gibbs just because of the recency and the draft capital. So you should be able to get them if you faded running back early. T's been in the third round pretty consistently. I've seen London fall quite a bit as of late. He was pretty bankably fourth round. He's starting to slide a little bit, and that's kind of been taken up by JSN. He's got hype around him this year as well. He's definitely going at least a full round ahead of the rest of the rookie wide receivers from this crop. I'm definitely fine with that price. It makes me like a couple of the other wide receivers in his class a little bit more at their value. So good place to put a pin in it. I'll move on to tier 6 here. But if you've enjoyed so far, don't forget to like and share the show. Interact with the polls. Always appreciate it. Let me know what type of content you guys want to hear. Once I get through all the tiers in here, I'm documenting to say that I'm not full of shit when I'm right or wrong on some players. But once I'm through all this, I'll get more into the different types of content that I want to get into. So here we are with tier 6. Tier 6 is, we're starting to get off the beaten path here. There's a bit more projection as we enter the fifth round of a startup draft around. But we'll start off with the quarterbacks again. Probably unpopular here too. It's Daniel Dimes. Daniel Jones. Holding asset. My New York Giants fandom means that valuing Daniel Jones is like exercising a demon. I want him to be great, but I can't deny what I've seen the last 4 years. Everybody loves Daniel Jones, top 10 quarterback of this past season. One thing I want to make clear, though, Daniel Jones is a volume rusher, not a dynamic rusher. He averaged 44 yards and about half a touchdown on the ground. That's great. But I've spoken multiple times about this with other rushing quarterbacks in previous tiering episodes. 38% of your fantasy points coming from rushing when the rest of your offense is crap is not something I'm willing to bet on. It's not the easiest thing in the world for a quarterback to repeat 7 touchdowns on the ground. I want to see Daniel Jones grow in other areas. I did like what I saw from him when he was asked to make some difficult throws, but let's not make it complicated. The deep game and the special throws were almost non-existent this year. This offense was clearly handicapped. There was a lid on it on purpose. It was very dink and dunk. And credit to Brian Daboll to getting us to the playoffs and, constructing some semblance of competent offense, something that, you know, Giants fans have been starved for a very long time. But he was a methodical game manager. Only 2 games with more than 250 passing yards. The trade for Darren Waller, I like a lot. He's a nice addition, of course, when he's healthy. He's probably the best player on our offense, not named Saquon Barkley. Even with him, though, the wide receiver core is still among one of the worst in the NFL. We've got a whole bunch of slot wide receivers. I'm interested to see what they're going to do. Interestingly enough, because Brian Daboll hails from New England, doesn't this look like a little 2014-2015 New England Patriots-y? You get your big mismatch weapon at tight end, then you got a million slot wide receivers, death by a thousand paper cuts, and a bunch of role players. Strong running game? I don't know. So again, it's not like it can't work. That's a tough projection, man. Even Tom Brady didn't always finish as a quarterback one, and he's the greatest of all time. So Daniel Jones is just 26 years old, but I've seen him as early as like the fourth round. Like, you can completely miss me with that. If it's going to take time for this team to get better, if that's the path you're trying to take, why don't you take Kyler Murray? Because at least he's a dynamic rushing threat, and he's working with about the same caliber of wide receiver talent over there. other than that, I think he's a very bankable QB2. Not taking him as a one. I'll take him, you know, somewhere in the fifth, sixth round if I don't like the way the quarterbacks look on my next pick. Do you know who I do really like, though, is Geno Smith. Ascending asset. Former Giant. If only we had just kept him around. We wouldn't have drafted Daniel Jones top six. But Geno Smith, congratulations on your Ryan Tannehill Award of 2022. Comeback Player of the Year. I don't know if he was actually Comeback Player of the Year, but he played his way into a really nice extension with Seattle. There was some talk about maybe them going the QB route in the draft because they had two first-round picks. They ended up not. Geno's the guy. Among the quarterbacks in this tier, he's probably got some of the most positive momentum going into next year because he just balled out. He was a guy that was very written off, but he didn't write back, though. Coming to this year, I don't expect another QB5 finish. This was kind of a QB Armageddon year. Also, Seattle was kind of abnormally pass-heavy for them. 572 attempts is, like, way out there. They don't throw the ball that much if they can help it. I want to say it was, like, top five or top six in the league. They average about 493 attempts over the past four seasons with Russell Wilson. Does that continue? Maybe not that level of output of nearly 600, but I do think that, you know, they found something with Geno Smith. All that time that we were talking about letting Russell Wilson cook, Geno just wore it better. And I'd expect that part to continue. The Seattle offense is improving. They ended up walking out of last year's draft with two starting tackles, which is unheard of, as well as drafting JSN and Zach Charbonnet this year. This team is on the rise, and I think he's among the best QB2s that you can get in the game, because I do think he can sneak up into that back end quarterback one conversation with his weapons. I got to tip my hat to JL on that one. That was one of his was one of my buddies' ride or dies last year, and it paid off in dividends for him. With this type of career arc, there's always going to be some danger of a one-hit wonder. That's taken into consideration as to why he's down here as well. But I would still consider him an ascending asset just because we thought this guy's starting career was completely deceased, and he had other plans. Not bad for a guy that cost you at most a 12th round pick and a startup last year. This is why you always take chances on quarterbacks. They have the highest payoff, and hopefully getting Geno Smith paid off for you last year. But now let's get to Kenny Pickett, ascending asset. He's another one that's kind of hard for me to value because I love the Steelers going into this year, and almost none of my Steelers love has anything to do with Kenny Pickett. He had an uncomfortable rookie season, to say the least. I do acknowledge the second half improvement. He was pretty good. Plays well out of structure, you know, off script making plays. He did a little bit of that last year. He does show flashes, but he played poorly in structure. And that's partly because this structure is poor. I do not understand why they brought back Matt Canundrum, because that was one of the things I was actually looking forward to with Kenny Pickett. Going into this offseason, I figured they'd get a different offensive mind in there, and then I would be more excited about Pickett. So now instead of saying Kenny Pickett's going to be better in 23 because he's got a brand new offensive system with yada yada, you're saying Kenny Pickett's going to be better in this year because Kenny Pickett's going to be better. Kind of a leap of faith here. That's not a good way to make your projections here. And I think that's evident not just in Kenny Pickett's ADP, but in his skill position players' ADP. Spoiler alert, we haven't gotten to any of them yet because nobody knows what the hell to expect from this offensive system. We all like the players that are in there, but we don't know how it's all going to fit and how it's going to shake out for fantasy. But back to Pickett. Omitting the two games that he missed to injury, which very quickly, by the way, lost in the shuffle of the Tua Tagovailoa concussion incident, Kenny Pickett had quite a few concussions last year too. Just something to point out. But omitting those two games that he missed to injury, his 17 game base would have been 297 completions, 3,400 yards, 17 touchdowns. That's okay, but it is just 1 year, and a rookie year at that. Could take a leap. Pittsburgh's bolstering their offensive line, and the hype coming out of Pittsburgh is deafening. So if it's real, we'll see. I still think Kenny Pickett is a great QB2 option. Just because of his weapons, if they can figure things out. He can rush a little bit, but I'm not going crazy as of yet. Man, fat quarterback tier, huh? Mac Jones, holding asset. Man, Mac Jones was terrible last year, wasn't he? Far cry from the moment in time where it looked like he might have been the best quarterback in a class that contained Trevor Lawrence. Man, some of that magic in New England ran out last year. Now, without dumping on Mac completely, most of us would agree that the situation in New England should improve across the board, if for nothing else, because they're going to be better coached. Matt Patricia was a disaster as an offensive mind. Damning decision on Bill Belichick's part to let him coach the offense. Anyway, you bring in Bill O'Brien, another maligned ex-New England figure for different reasons, but Bill O'Brien could coach an offense, both as an OC in the Patriots, as well as the head coach of the Texans. I'm fine with that aspect. Also worth noting that I believe the New England offensive line was learning some degree of a new scheme. It was supposed to be like this hybrid mesh between what New England usually does with some outside zone stuff that has been permeating the league because of Kyle Shanahan. Didn't go very well. Line wasn't very good. And this offense is still not going to make leaps and bounds here. Even with Bill O'Brien coming in, this is another playmaking group that is just still lacking. The only key free agent signing was Juju Smith-Schuster, who's shown pretty thoroughly at this point that he's not the elite asset we thought he was 3 or 4 years ago. And then you got Devontae Parker still kicking around. Kendrick Bourne. Yet to see anything from Tyquan Thornton. They drafted Demario Douglas this year. A couple of veteran tight ends. It's not looking good here. So I don't think Mac will be embarrassing himself, which is why I don't have him down as a declining asset. But I don't think he's ascending right now. So I'm fine stashing him in the range that he's going in startups, but I'm not getting my hopes up. And we have arrived at Mr. Irrelevant himself, Brock Purdy, ascending asset. At long last, the San Francisco quarterback controversy comes to what should be a merciful end after nearly 3 years. A bit bittersweet as a former Trey Lance truther. Full disclosure, I was very in on Trey Lance when he was being drafted. The Niners trading absolute fortune to go get him. Could have been a safe thing to rest your hat on, but ended up not being the case. While I fully accept the miss on Trey Lance, I do have to say that going back and looking why I like Trey Lance so much, writing through all my notes and stuff, it was more just about the offensive system that I was really intrigued by. All of the warning signs were there for Trey Lance, and at the end of the day, I didn't really care because I figured he would grow and flourish in one of the most quarterback-friendly schemes the league has ever seen. And so, in a roundabout way, we'll just pretend I was a little bit right. But anyway, let's get more into Brock Purdy here. So, in case you were living under a rock, he was the definitive story of the second half of the season. Last pick of the NFL draft as a rookie, comes in as the third string QB for the Niners, rescues the season from certain destruction. Fantasy-wise, he finishes as QB9 from weeks 13 to the 18. There were legit scenarios where this guy who came completely out of nowhere was plucked off waiver wires and dropped onto championship teams, and teams won fantasy titles with Brock Purdy as a quarterback. It definitely happened. So was it real? Well, I think it's real. Again, I do have a very hard time believing you can find a quarterback that's actually a professional quarterback that would look terrible in this offense, because Shanahan's been dealing with this same song and dance since they cut ties with Kaepernick back in 2017. That's 6 years of quarterback carousel, and the Niners have been a force in the postseason regardless. So as far as Purdy's production specifically, he did exactly what he was asked to do because this offense was steamrolling people. But not a lot of this offensive success was directly from Purdy. He was very much just a point guard. For one, there's not much deep passing to speak of here. Not that that's prominently featured in any iteration of the Shanahan offense that we've seen in San Francisco. But you do take that into consideration when you're considering a guy's upside. And second, because we already know what this offense is. San Francisco is an elite collection of skill position players that specialize in yards after the catch. Debo Samuel, George Kittle, and Brandon Ayuk all excel turning 5-yard gains into 12-yard gains. And that's what leads to things like Purdy averaging over 9 yards per attempt on screens, which is an astronomically high number. And his percentage of dropbacks that were screens was, you know, on the higher side among starting quarterbacks in the league. Also, another small thing, As it pertains to quarterback pressure, Purdy was pressured on 43 dropbacks in his sample, which really doesn't sound like all that much, but yet he had the third highest percentage of pressure dropbacks that were on some level his fault, up at almost 28%. For context, The other guys in that range were Deshaun Watson, Lamar Jackson, Mitchell Trubisky, Justin Fields, Jimmy Garoppolo. So guys that we have historically for a few years now said that they kind of invite pressure. Truthfully, I think because he played so well in structure and because Kyle Shanahan's structure is so good, I don't mind him, you know, freelancing and doing more of some of that chaotic stuff to try and scramble and make a play out of nothing. But it's just something to consider because all of his stats look screwy because he's only got a 6-game sample here. So all of it's going to be subject to interpretation. Then you add in the torn UCL that he suffered in the playoffs. I've maintained this entire process that even though he's cleared to play again, I don't think he's going to be 100%. Being cleared to play and being 100% and being able to, you know, rip it if you need to are two very different things. While a UCL repair may be a bigger deal in the MLB than in the NFL, it is just something I'm monitoring as well. At the end of the day, he gets the vote of confidence from Kyle Shanahan saying that he's the guy, which is really all you need to hear about what you should be thinking about with Purdy going forward. So I do have him up here with the rest of these upside QB2s because that's what he is. He's a high floor QB2 in this offense in a great situation with some upside for more. If he can repeat, if this offense can stay healthy, I'm a little worried about the offensive line turnover, but for as late as you can find Purdy in a startup draft, you could do a lot worse to find a guy with his type of upside. Aaron Rodgers, a descending asset. Maybe that seems harsh, but I have no idea what to expect from Aaron Rodgers in New York other than this newfound baseline of no Devontae Adams. Wasn't good last year, was it? Aaron Rodgers was a quarterback 2 for your fantasy team last year. Took a step back with underwhelming cast of weapons. I very loudly made bets that Derek Carr was going to finish as a better fantasy quarterback than Aaron Rodgers would. That ended up not being case in the final rankings, but they only finished 30 points apart, QB 13 versus QB 16. It was more to illustrate that I was not in on the Packers last year. So where do we go from here with Aaron Rodgers? Well, he's going to turn 40 this year, ditches Green Bay for gangrene. Still no Devontae Adams, but, Garrett Wilson's a nice consolation prize. That's promising, but what about his peripheral weapons? He brought over Alan Lazard and Randall Cobb. They still have Corey Davis kicking around there. They also signed Mecole Hardman. Is this playmaker group any better than what he had when he had just Devontae Adams in Green Bay? Because I lean no. Truthfully, though, that might be enough to keep him in good graces for fantasy. At least, if nothing else, to get him back into the top 12. Will not be without its challenges, though. We're only a few weeks into the preseason, and he's already gotten back-to-back calf tweaks over this offseason. This offensive line, too, is going to be a rough unit, at least on paper. I also expect him to be very run-heavy. At full strength, I think this team is going to want to lean on Breece Hall. They also just signed Dalvin Cook. So I think that MVP form is a little rosy of an outcome. But in terms of short-term bets, he's Aaron Rodgers. On a 1 or 2 year window, he's not a bad bet compared to the rest of the quarterbacks in this tier if you want some potentially elite production right now. Now we get to the running backs, and we'll lead off with Ramondre Stevenson, ascending asset. I know it hurts that Ezekiel Elliott just signed in New England. And you know what? Maybe the Zeke signing won't be so bad, but the signing further clouds a worrisome projection from Ramondre Stevenson. Ramondre Stevenson was a PPR machine. 69 receptions on 80 targets at 6 foot 227 is just a fascinating skill set. Think like Najee Harris almost. Najee's a little bit bigger. Stevenson's got more wiggle to him. But that's the type of player we're dealing with here. Was spectacular this year for a pretty good stretch. Was RB5 from weeks 3 to 13. But after that, his receiving just cratered. Possibly due to the ankle injury that he suffered late in the season, he was efficient and he was good after contact when he ran the ball. All good things, right? Well, let's get to some of the more concerning items. For one, it was just inconsistent production on the ground. He did have a couple of 100-yard games, but he had more games under 60 yards than over 60 yards. 10 games versus 7 games. And that was with backfield mate Damian Harris in and out of the lineup for most of the year. Not to mention, Ramondre Stevenson also had a 50% snap share in all but 3 games of this year. Let's remember, New England is the OG running back by committee. They were doing this before anybody else did. No New England running back has managed more than 3 weeks of 50% snap share since 2019 James White. Then you start adding the Zeke signing and the other peripheral pieces on this team and their general methodology towards running backs, and it makes you wonder what Ramondre Stevenson's role is going to be this year. Does Zeke take on that early down and red zone work? Does that hurt Ramondre Stevenson's touchdown upside? Does he just mix in on passing downs to be a general pain in the ass? Because he is a good pass blocker, after all. I'd be remiss if I didn't at least mention the name Ty Montgomery. He signed with New England last year, ended up leaving week one of last season with a season-ending ankle injury, I believe. But he had a great game, specifically in the passing game, and he's more built like that James White, Deion Lewis type that has a lot of success in New England. So is he more of a factor on passing downs? Is he and Zeke both on passing downs? Does that mean Ramondre goes to the Damian Harris role? Or do they just say fuck it all and load Ramondre up like 2004 Corey Dillon? There's a reason why people say that they don't like valuing or trusting New England running backs. I think that's a bit tired these days, just because I think we've gotten better at examining role players and tendencies with these running back committees across the league. But still, they are so amorphous, they will change and do anything that they see fit. And usually, as it pertains to the running game, they know what they're doing and they have pretty good success. It's just a worry for me, because as you continuously slice small pieces of the pie off what Ramondre Stevenson had, you're increasing his potential for volatility. And history tells us that that snap count is probably going to come down. Yeah, I love Ramondre, but he's a tough eval, man. But great player, very unique player, and I'm looking forward to see more in him next year. Next running back up, Najee Harris. I got him as a holding asset. After a miserable 22 season in Pittsburgh, both because the offense was terrible and because he was nursing a Lisfranc sprain, you know, finishing as RB14 ain't half bad for Najee. Not what you wanted from him, though. He was highly drafted. Funnily enough, as bad as that offensive line was made out to be, he put up almost identical production on the ground this year as he did last year, but what killed you was the receptions. His PPR floor was cut nearly in half with no Big Ben, from 74 receptions down to 41. If you ask me, I don't think that level of volume is ever coming back for Najee. I think that was purely a function of who his quarterback was and how he solved problems when there wasn't a read open. I think while Pickett will use Najee Harris a little bit more on those off-script plays, he's of course got the legs to make more happen outside the pocket, and that's just not as reliant on the running back these days. Don't get me wrong, though. The offense was not good. The offensive line was especially not good. Najee Harris is the only running back with over 250 carries to total fewer than 600 yards before contact. And if you put the touchdowns aside, that puts him in a very similar category to Jamal Williams, who was pretty much a goal line specialist for the Lions. That line was poo-poo. There was no room for explosive runs or breakaway runs or anything like that. So going into year two, you're hoping that Kenny Pickett takes a step. They've remade this offensive line with signing Isaac Seumalo from Philly, bringing in James Daniels, drafting left tackle Broderick Jones, and low-key, really excited about the Darnell Washington pick here. I really don't get the hype around Darnell Washington as a fantasy player, but, dude, as a run blocker, this is one of those really low-key scheme fits that I really love for real football. If they can get him on the field as the tight end two, offset on the edge, Pittsburgh loves to terrorize the D-gap. They've done it with just about every notable back over the past 10 years. Le'Veon Bell, James Conner. Yeah, that'd be sweet. Not counting on that this year, though. Worth mentioning, Jaylen Warren, backfield mate, was pretty freaking spry last year. I know this day and age, we're not crazy about the subject of handcuffs. It's not really something that needs to be done, but he's a fine handcuff if you really want to get him. Might have some standalone value, too. I don't think long-term he's a significant threat to Najee's volume. If anything, I want him on the field to keep Najee fresh. But I think a volume-safe RB2 assumption isn't out of the question here for Najee. On to Javonte Williams. Now, full transparency, I have him down as a declining asset, but I'm starting to get just a little bit excited again. The Javonte Williams train has been a roller coaster ride for me. He was one of my favorite prospects when he was coming out. It seemed like he was poised for liftoff after a promising rookie season, finished his RB17, and was among the highest running backs in yards after contact per attempt on just 40% of the snaps sharing a backfield with Melvin Gordon. Really liked this guy. I thought he was kind of like a better Kareem Hunt. Unfortunately, suffered a fairly complex ACL injury. I've been way out on him since just because, first of all, I usually like to give 2 years to expect a player to go back to 100%, but specifically because there was other damage aside from the clean ACL that does cloud recovery as well, and it in some cases can affect explosiveness. So just as I was beginning to finish my grief process, Denver started insisting that he will be active and playing in the preseason. I'm tempering my expectations. This is, of course, a new offense for him, and he's coming off the ACL, but it's encouraging to say the least. If I'm looking to hang my hat on something a little fleeting and maybe false hope-ish, is that Javonte is a downhill runner. He is physical, he is at you, and he's not really dependent on the same, you know, side-to-side jump cuts and whatnot. So if there was a question of explosiveness coming off this type of injury, maybe it wouldn't be so bad in his case. I don't know, I'm not a doctor. But this is kind of going to put him on a similar trajectory to Breece, where I'm not expecting the world in the beginning. I want to see him out there. I want to see him healthy. And if things look okay, I might be looking at him as like a second half target. Again, Breece's ACL was pretty clean compared to Javonte's, so this is still a major factor here. But I'd really love to see Javonte in a Sean Payton offense. They'll be leaning heavy on the run as they try to rehab Russell Wilson's career. There's, of course, no major investments in his backfield ahead of him. They did sign Samaje Perine in free agency. He'll definitely have a role either way. And I think they're comfortable giving him as much run as he can take to shoulder the load on Javonte. But they definitely don't seem like they're just going to move off Javonte. So I'm looking at him as sort of a speculative ad in some places where I'm going to be contending now or very soon. Just because I want to be the guy holding him when he comes back. Regardless, he's just a guy of mine and hoping for good things. All right, back in the wide receiver groove. I'm going to duck when I say this one. Calvin Ridley, holding asset. I am fully aboard the Ridley train in case you have short-term memory loss. Calvin Ridley was an ascendant, proven alpha-level wide receiver way back in 2020. Before all this craziness happened, he finished as wide receiver 5 with 90 receptions for 1,300 yards and 9 touchdowns, had 8 100-yard games. While Julio Jones was in and out of the lineup, he was taking over. It was time. Julio was passing the torch to Ridley. Everything was great in Atlanta. But in early 2021, his play was struggling a little bit. Needed a short leave of absence to take care of some mental health stuff. And then shortly after that was suspended for a year for violating the gambling policy. He hasn't played a down of football since, and I almost don't care because that's how friggin' good he is. It was certainly more of a question mark earlier in the offseason, but now that camp is fully underway, we're actually seeing Calvin Ridley. He looks phenomenal in Jags camp. Reports are glowing. His visibility in camp has hushed a lot of those concerns that I had, but I gotta stay real here. While he's definitely one of my flag plant guys this year, he will be turning 29 at the end of the season. This is a minuscule window to vault up to a high tier status. It's just not likely. He's not going to be a pick that's going to be for every roster. If he was to join the tier 3 with Tyreek and Diggs and Kupp and the other veteran receivers, like it would have to be done this year, which is an impossible ask, but it's not like he doesn't have the talent and the upside to do it. He's now tied to Trevor Lawrence for the next few years. Barring any other unforeseen circumstances, I'm looking forward to getting Calvin Ridley back in the high wide receiver ranks and dominating in your fantasy lineup. Here's a rookie here, Jordan Addison, ascending asset. Jordan Addison is fully in that undersized, shifty wide receiver mold that the league is moving towards. He is 6'1", 175, soaking wet. That's not an insult or anything. Hey, I have Devontae Smith high in my rankings, but, you know, we're going to talk about it. Not the biggest guy. Also had middling athletic testing as well. Don't even care, honestly. That's not going to make or break him because he is fully a crafty route runner, and I expect his integration into Minnesota's offense to be pretty quick, if not seamless. I think he'll be stepping into the Adam Thielen role, who's departed to Carolina. I don't know how much slot work he's going to get, but I think just looking at the Vikings personnel, he's been drafted to be a boundary receiver playing opposite Justin Jefferson, obviously be on the field in three wide receiver sets either way. And assuming he's up to speed, even in two tight end sets, which I think the Vikings will run a bit more of this year, I think it'll be KJ Osborne that's going to get bumped off the field and not Jordan Addison, because KJ Osborne plays about 60% of his snaps from the slot. I don't want to glaze over the fact that playing alongside Justin Jefferson as a rookie could pay dividends. I think he's an easy bet for one of the better rookie seasons from a wide receiver of this class. And I could envision some scenarios where I could be counting on him with a competing roster for some wide receiver three potential. Now here's a fun one here. DJ Moore, holding asset. So DJ Moore is the epitome of wide receiver fatigue. It has been very interesting watching DJ Moore's trajectory since he came into the league. As recently as two seasons ago, this guy was ranked in the top 12 wide receivers unanimously. And not without reason. The guy rightfully places well in advanced metrics. We're still waiting for DJ Moore to take that step, unfortunately. And to add insult to injury, he took a small step back this year as well. Before this year, though, DJ Moore was one of the most consistent fantasy wide receivers out there. Three consecutive seasons with 1,000 yards, at least 390 yards after the catch, and anywhere between 80 and 100 of his targets that came in a season were coming inside the 20-yard line. So short and intermediate, he specializes in those areas because of his route running and his yards after catch. And those are pretty high watermarks. He was consistently ranked among some of the best wide receivers in the league. Where was he in 2022? Down to 888 yards, down from 1,000. 191 yards after catch, down from 390 average. And just 60 of his targets came inside the 20. His role completely changed this year, and you felt that inconsistency week to week. And what do you know? This down season happened to coincide with Carolina's quarterback Armageddon. Yes, DJ Moore has made the best of subpar quarterbacks over the years. No shade to Cam Newton, but, you know, eventually there comes a point where it just becomes unsustainable. And I would say a rotating door of Baker Mayfield, Sam Darnold, and Matt Corral is the definition of unsustainable. But anyway, that team crumbles. Carolina liquidates. End up trading DJ Moore in a cruel twist of fate for a very accurate quarterback in Bryce Young. But he lands in Chicago, and honestly, I think he's going to land on his feet. I think he fits well what the Bears want to do on offense, and there's really no targets spoken for ahead of him on the depth chart. You know, they got some guys there, but they desperately need a number one wide receiver, and it's going to uplift the whole offense. It's going to make Justin Fields look better. Probably going to make DJ Moore look better too. So while I'm not getting my hopes up for some crazy wide receiver finish for DJ Moore, I do think he could impress with some sneaky volume up in Chicago. And I think he makes a great bounce back candidate, because everything else that we've seen from this guy has been good, if not very good. Victim of circumstance, and let's see if a change of scenery can help him get back on track. Now we got Brandon Ayuk, another holding asset. I mean, you could probably talk me into him being an ascending asset. I am personally drinking the Kool-Aid on Ayuk. I think he's the guy to own in San Francisco ahead of Debo and Kittle, both this year and in Dynasty. Not only is he the youngest and the healthiest of the bunch, I think he's also the most versatile. There's a bit of a Tyreek, Jalen Waddle dynamic between Debo and Ayuk as well. They have some overlapping skill sets, and they complement each other very well. And he's the primary X receiver, whereas Debo's kind of like in and out and all over the place. Ayuk is a stable presence there on the outside, and he does great work over the intermediate part of the field. And while it's not a huge part of Kyle Shanahan's offense to go deep very often, that's going to be Ayuk's territory as well. He's a great deep ball runner on the limited chances that he gets a year to do it. So the problem with Ayuk is the same problem for all the San Francisco skill positions, not named Christian McCaffrey, is that they're all somewhat capped. Not only is this a low volume passing offense, because this is Kyle freaking Shanahan, he will pound the rock until you force him to stop. There are a couple of games a year where the Niners are just able to steamroll over people with 30 to 35 rushing attempts a game, and no passing was needed on that day, which is really annoying for fantasy, but it's good football. And the other thing is that none of these San Francisco pass catchers averages more than 8 targets in a game. those targets are not always divvied up evenly, and so it can sometimes lead to touchdown-dependent outings or some feast or famine weeks from other guys. And then you start throwing Christian McCaffrey in the mix. It just gets messy. But I put my stamp on Brandon Ayuk on this team. I think he's the cleanest, most consistent, healthiest, youngest guy that they have. And that bodes well for his dynasty value. And he's another guy where if, you know, things break right, you know, he could have another good year. He finished his wide receiver 15 this year. But I love me some Brandon Ayuk. And I got two wide receivers left, and I'm going to talk about them in the same tier at the same time because they're on the same team. There's a triple-double for you. It's Jahan Dotson and Terry McLaurin, ascending and holding assets respectively. I value these guys very similarly as well. I think in redraft leagues, Dotson is the value just because he goes a lot later than McLaurin. But because of McLaurin's age, I think he's the value compared to Dotson because there's a bit of Terry McLaurin fatigue as well. And speaking of fatigue, he is a little DJ Moore-esque, isn't he, with his stat totals. Three straight 1,000-yard seasons. He's an impressive route runner. It's always going to be a thing tied to him that he's an older prospect. He's only been in the league 4 years, and he's going to turn 28 at the very beginning of the season. Sneaks up on you. But he's shown every step of the way that despite the poor situation he's been in, he's a consummate number one wide receiver. He's awesome. Entered Jahan Dotson, last year's rookie first-round pick. He was off the charts good in his first season. Yes, it was shortened due to injury, and yes, he still caught 7 touchdowns in just 12 games. That's an unsustainable pace, but he was freaking awesome. Both of these guys are incredible. Other thing to note about these two guys is neither one of them is enormous. They're not small by any means as far as receivers go, but both of them are incredible at contested catches. They are actually the fourth best duo behind Jamar Chase and T. Higgins, Mike Evans, Chris Godwin, and A.J. Brown and Devontae Smith. And they are the only duo to complete over 60% of those contested catches. The only thing that sucks about these two is they're just let down by subpar QB play. They were both dealing with Carson Wentz and Taylor Heineke. This year, though, for the Commanders, they bring over Eric Bieniemy from the Chiefs. Hopefully, his presence will put a fresh twist on this offense. I'd like to see these two go at it in this new scheme. As for the starter this year, Sam Howell is believed to be the week one starter. He's still an unknown, and that's still not confirmed as of now. They do still have Jacoby Brissett if they do need to begin the season with him. He could also come in relief during the midseason. And truth be told, I might slightly be more comfortable with Brissett under center week one than I would Howell, but, you know, we'll see how it goes. It's a shame that, you know, this is just one of those situations where you have two very talented players. You drop, you know, I mean, like a quarterback remotely worth his salt in this offense, and he could put up some pretty awesome numbers. But until we get the quarterback figured out, that's just what's going to keep these guys lower. And hopefully we'll be singing a different tune by next year. All right, now to the tight ends. Took a break from him in Tier 5, back again in Tier 6. TJ Hockenson leading it off. Ascending asset. TJ Hockenson is one of the guys that has helped reestablish the mid-tier tight end class for fantasy. Years ago, if you've been playing long enough, there was a group of non-elite tight ends that were getting elite target shares, at least for the position. So we're not talking about your Gronkowski or your Jimmy Graham or any of those ridiculous freak of nature specimens. But we're talking about your Greg Olsen, your Zach Ertz, your Delanie Walker, your Jason Witten. Guys that just weren't going to break you, weren't going to let you down. Hockenson was already off to a great start to the season and ended up getting traded in division to Minnesota. And that went just as swimmingly. Without skipping a beat, he was averaging 8.5 targets a game in Minnesota. He was also uniquely good at contested catch situations, led all tight ends in contested catches on the season. All in all, stellar season from TJ Hockenson. I would put him higher, but I'm going to need to see it again. Maybe I'm just being a curmudgeon, but not seeing too many target shares like TJ Hockenson's pop up. You know, with Jordan Addison coming in, you know, I think part of what might have precipitated the TJ Hockenson trade in the first place was the Vikings realizing that Adam Thielen had lost 5 steps about 2 years ago. They needed to figure out a contingency plan because they were winning and they ended up making the playoffs. So I think TJ Hockenson was their best bet. we'll see how Jordan Addison gets integrated into the offense. I just know that tight end target shares can vanish as quickly as they appear. I've seen it many times over the years with this position. But I like TJ Hockenson, and I'd like to see more from him next year. Now we got Brittle Kittle. George Kittle is a holding asset for me. Make no mistake about it, this man is an elite tight end when he steps on the field. He's kind of taken the mantle as the Gronk of this current NFL, because he just has some of those crazy Herculean runs and tackle-breaking ability and crushing run blocks. He's very much taken that mantle from Gronkowski. So he's elite when he steps on the field. Now, how many consecutive steps we can get him to take on a field per season remains a constant variable with this guy. He has not played a full season since his breakout 2018, and he's already been hit with the perennial camp soft tissue injury. And even when he's on the field, he's usually hobbled by something. And all of these nagging injuries combined with the Kyle shenanigans of how he runs this offense, plus the tumultuous QB situation through the last few years, has led to many a bust season for anybody that has drafted George Kittle. So you figured I'd be done, right? No. Because when Brock Purdy was under center, this pass game caught fire in a way that it really did not with Jimmy Garoppolo. And George Kittle was a major beneficiary of that. He had 7 touchdowns in the final 4 games. Even on his season as a whole, his production was extremely touchdown dependent. He finished as tight end 3, but had 11 touchdowns. If you take the touchdowns away, though, his yardage was very feast or famine. He had 5 games over 80 yards while having 9 games under 40 yards. There was no in between. The touchdowns were the only stabilizing force to his production, which is a bit of an oxymoron. So I wouldn't recommend that every team tries to chase the Kittle dragon outside of tight end premium leagues, but he truly has a rare type of upside that keeps him relevant and in this conversation. And because of the position he plays, a position that can often be feast and famine by nature, it's sometimes worth rolling the dice on an imperfect projection, and that is George Kittle to a T. And the last tight end that I got here is Darren Waller. I'm going to put him down as a declining asset. I think that's reasonable. You know, everybody loves Kyle Pitts, right? Well, Darren Waller was the OG Kyle Pitts. This dude is a monster. 6'6", 245. He is a rare matchup weapon all over the field. He can play X receiver. He can ISO on the outside. He is an elite tight end that has unfortunately been marred by back-to-back injury-plagued seasons. It's funny how quickly we forget how great Darren Waller was. He was putting down 90 reception seasons like nothing. This past season, when he was on the field, though, he still took a backseat to Devontae Adams in the new offense under Josh McDaniels with the Raiders. He ended up getting traded to the Giants in this offseason. I think instantly he becomes the most talented downfield option that is both on the Giants roster currently and probably the best player Daniel Jones has ever played with. Health permitting, I do see some insane volume because there's just nothing spoken for targets in this offense. But truthfully, I think you got to keep him as a declining asset because if it doesn't go well this year, if he just keeps getting hurt, the cliff is pretty scary. Psych, I got one more for you because I can't count, and it's Dalton Kincaid. I'll make this one pretty quick, though, just because, you know, he's a rookie, so I don't have a ton of stats to go on. But I have a rule, and that rule is I very often don't give a crap about rookie tight ends, because so few of them have gone over 1,000 yards in their first year, and it usually takes many years for them to develop. And the very minute you think that you've found one for a long-term solution, he can turn to dust, and you're back playing the waiver wire again. Not to mention, no one knows how to value tight ends, depending on whether or not you play tight end premium or not. But I have the luxury of not giving a fuck about tight ends, and Dalton Kincaid breaks that rule. Watching his tape, he is one of the most impressive tight ends I've ever seen. He has legitimate receiver chops. He might as well not even be a tight end. He's basically a slot receiver. But he can catch the ball and track the ball and move after the catch in the same conversation as Travis Kelce and Kyle Pitts. The Bills drafted him in the first round. I think if things go well, he will be leaned on heavily because Buffalo has been searching for a reliable number two option for Josh Allen. So I can have my principles all that I want, but I can't ignore a damn good football player when I see one. The way he catches the ball, he's not your average tight end, and I can't value him as such. So he's definitely a guy that I'm willing to stick my neck out for in some situations. He's still a tight end, so I'm not going to go out of my way to do that. But I'm open to the idea, very open to the idea in a lot of places. But that's it. I showed emotion to the tight end position. Now I got to go back to Stoneface. We're done here. And that'll round out tier six. Final thoughts on this tier. We're kind of spanning quite a few picks here and quite a few rounds. I think the stickiest guys are going to be some of these wide receivers. Jordan Addison, DJ Moore, Calvin Ridley pretty much dominate the fifth round. Brandon Ayuk might slip more towards the sixth, but they're kind of the barometer that you're using here because the quarterbacks go all up and down the board from the fourth all the way down to the ninth. I'm not kidding. Obviously, Daniel Jones is going to profile high because of his recent success with his legs and his age. So I've seen him pop up into the fourth in some occasions. Highest I've seen Kenny Pickett go is the fifth. But from there, it's a free-for-all. There's guys that are going off the board there I don't even have in this tier yet. And I spoke in my very first episode, the Startup Primer, that quarterback is one of the only positions you have to expect volatile picks from round to round. So it's just something that you have to consider. Different guys are going to be taken at different spots because reaching for a quarterback isn't going to be as bad as being left without one. Comes with the territory. That'll do it, though. I greatly appreciate anybody who stuck around to the end. Don't forget to like and share the show. Interact with the polls. And until next time, I'll see you later. Keep grinding.